From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
One of the most common questions garden centers and other garden professionals are asked these days, how can I add more pollinator plants? Today's guest designs ecological gardens with such beneficial insects in mind and is the author of the new book, The Pollinator Victory Garden. More in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Kim Ironman is founder of Eco Beneficial, consulting on ecological landscaping and design. Based in Westchester County, New York, Kim speaks nationwide to spread her passion for habitat-style plantings, creates an occasional podcast series on the subject, and is the author of the new book, The Pollinator Victory Garden. Welcome, Kim. I think we all need a pollinator victory garden, don't we?
Thank you for having me, Margaret.
Yes, especially after the winter. I tell you, I'd like to see some of the guys buzzing around.
Very, very soon.
Yes. So I should say before we get started that we'll have a book giveaway on Away to Garden with the transcript of this show so people can come and get all the details and more links and pictures and enter the book giveaway. So I guess the place to start is the basics, like why, to your mind, native is important, and how do you define, in your work, how do you define what native means? Because over the years, I've heard many, many definitions, and it's evolved, and I'm just interested to see where you are on that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it can be very confusing to people that are trying to make the transition to native to figure out what the heck that means.
Yeah.
So I always default to the federal executive order, as scintillating as that sounds. And they define native species as plants and animals that occur naturally, either presently or historically, in any ecosystem in the U.S. So how do I use that? Well, I try to apply this to regional ecosystems, to use a geographic qualifier with the word native. So our best practice would be to garden with plants that are native to our particular county or area. And again, they would have to be properly adapted to our site because not all sites are the same. And then we might have a broader definition native to the Northeast or, you know, so on and so on. So why is this important? It comes down to this one simple word, evolution.
Yeah.
The evolutionary interconnections between plants and animals and sometimes between plants themselves, really, really important. And I think the poster child for this over the last decade has been the monarch butterfly and its obligate larval host plant, milkweeds, the 100-plus species of milkweeds in the United States. But there's so many other connections that sometimes we just don't even know about that make native plants particularly important. But my book covers, I don't know, probably 10 points of why natives are important.
Yes. Yes, yes. And so so you're going somewhat local, yes, regional or local, yes?
Really try to focus on, yes, regional
yes.
native plants, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I know that, you know, you just mentioned Northeast, both of us are in the Northeast,
mm-hmm.
but the great thing when I came to the site and when I looked at the book, you provide information and plant lists and so forth. You have where we can come to the website and find access to databases of plants no matter where we live.
Right. I have a lot of regional lists. In addition to what you see in the book, there are a lot of regional lists of pollinator plants that cover North America. But I really encourage folks to do a little research.
Yes.
Just don't blindly look at a list. So get a reference, understand kind of where that's taking you, and then please investigate and join your local native plant society. Where you are, be the Native Plant Trust. Where I am, it's the Native Plant Center of New York. And there are so many great native plant organizations that have regional plant lists on their website. New Jersey is a case in point. California
right.
is a fantastic website with native plants. So do a little digging is my answer. There's no one size fits all here.
And since I have readers and listeners all over the place, I have done a little digging and I have a list. And what I'll do is that it involves some of the ones like CalFlora and
mm-hmm.
the New York State the flora of New York State, the plant atlas, and so forth. And some other ones, comparable ones around the country. So what I'll do is, since we're talking about it with the link, with the transcript of this show, I'll give a link to that. Obviously, I haven't done every single one, but I love your suggestion, just like with birders. People say, well, how can I learn about this? How can I learn about that? And I'm like,
sure.
Go to your local bird club's website. Go to a meeting. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's the best way to find out from other people who are into it in your area, right?
And I have a lot of resource websites and books on the Pollinator Victory Garden part of my website to help readers kind of get to the right resource.
Good. So we'll give all those good links. So, okay, so now we sort of set the stage. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about local, and even though many plants are native to the United States, to other regions, you know, something that's a prairie plant, that's not native to the Northeast, so it's not native for me and so forth. So matching to your, So now that we've kind of established that, as we walk around our yards this spring, we gardeners, you know, and as you do with clients, prospective clients or established clients you're visiting again, kind of where are some of the spots in the landscape as you're walking around doing a consult or whatever that you are looking to find to sort of transform into more native-heavy areas? Are there places you're on the lookout for because you have this expertise?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So my number one target is the lawn, what I call the green desert. It truly is an ecological wasteland for pollinators. So it can be a bit much to ask someone who's had a lawn for 20, 30 more years to give it all up. And I think that's often unrealistic. So I suggest that we start with small areas and replace lawn with what I call pollinator islands. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to do, and we can include more islands over time and connect them to create bigger landscapes. But I find that with most of us, if a project becomes too large and overwhelming, we don't do it at all. So better that we get started with smaller spaces. And an example of kind of a no-brainer conversion to a pollinator area would be a hillside that is currently in turf grass.
Right.
Who wants to mow that?
Not Margaret, Kim, not Margaret.
No. So why not just let's get rid of that and think about lower-growing plants, perhaps meadow-like plants. We can do a formal or an informal design depending on the person's taste. But why not take the low-hanging fruit and convert it into a pollinator habitat and garden? And I really recommend that you start with an area that you're going to see all the time. So maybe if you're a cook like me and you're always in the kitchen, you're looking out the window, get a garden out there. So you kind of see what's going on and you start to appreciate what the function of a pollinator garden is really doing, all the different creatures that are coming.
And I really believe in all garden design. I'm not a garden designer like you are, you know, but I always say when I'm lecturing, I say, hey, you know, go inside, look out the window. See what your vistas are, what your, you know, what axial views you have from the key windows that you use your house in, because that's where you're going to be able to pat yourself on the back and get some reward for your work. And
absolutely.
You know what I mean?
And even to including some seating areas outdoors. So when you're in the garden, be in the garden.
Yes.
I mean, like in the middle of the action, make an area where you can actually enjoy what's going on, seeing the hummingbirds and the bees and the butterflies, et cetera.
Yeah. So we hear and read on podcasts or garden lectures and books about habitat-style gardening to plant in layers. That phrase is often used. And, you know, not to plant the way we do, you know, a 30-foot tree and a 3-inch lawn or just having miles of 3-inch lawn, but plant like nature does in layers. And you say in the book, though, when advocating for lawn reduction, you say don't replace one monoculture with another. So tell us about that.
Sure. So, say we're looking at the lawn and we're thinking, oh, we're going to make this pollinator garden. Well, there's a temptation to just choose one plant. And that doesn't really work well for pollinators because there are many different types of pollinators, bees, butterflies, bats, moths, depending on where you are in the country. You know, beetles are the largest group of pollinators. And they all have different preferences of pollinator plants. They also are active at different times of year. So when we're designing, we really need to think about, first of all, diversity. So we have a diverse array of plants that attract a diverse array of pollinators. And just an example, you know, hummingbirds really love red tubular flowers. They don't not cast in stone. They always go to them, but those are their favorites. But a very small bee will probably need a very open flower because it doesn't have a lot of body strength or tongue length, and it will prefer a bright white or a yellow or a violet or a blue-colored flower. So the diversity of bloom is really important, but also the succession of bloom is really key. From depending on where you are, if you're in California, you've already started your gardening probably in certain parts of California, but for us here in the Northeast, early spring through late fall, and although we want to have diversity of bloom, we also have to have sufficiency of bloom. I call that achieving floral balance. So what's that about? Well, pollinators like bees and butterflies have a behavior called floral constancy or floral fidelity. And that means when they go off on a foraging mission, they're looking for one species of plant. So we need to provide targets for them to accommodate that. And that can be done in a couple ways. One, we can create a big group of plants of one species. Research out of University of California has shown that a 1 square meter grouping is ideal. But we can't always do that because of space considerations, et cetera. So another way to approach it is to repeat smaller groupings in the landscape. The pollinators will find them. Or to have a meadowscape type of arrangement with an erratic amount of bloom. But it's all about biodiversity when we're thinking of pollinators, and especially in the face of climate change.
So when we bring home native plants from the garden center, we shouldn't, just like when we're trying to design any garden, even just for pure aesthetics, and even of non-natives, bringing onesies home, one of this, one of that, one of the other thing, isn't going to do the trick, even though we can say, oh, I have 20 new native plants in my garden. We want to have this a little bit of a mass of each type, yes? Like you're
absolutely
saying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So trees and shrubs kind of help us out a little bit, especially the larger ones, because we've got good biomass there.
Yeah.
So we might be able to get away with, one of a given shrub or tree, but, just be aware that many of our plants that are native do require a pollinator partner. That's what I call them. They may either be, like our native hollies, or dioecious male and female plants, and we need both to provide the pollen on the male plants for particularly for bees to build their brood. It's the main source of protein, but also the fruit on the females. So a lot of these plants are dioecious, and a lot of plants like our native viburnums, even though they don't have different sexes, they're not always reliably self-fruitful.
No.
Meaning they need a genetically different partner near them for cross-pollination by insects to produce fruit.
Yeah, a little bit of homework is a good thing, gardeners.
Yeah.
Right?
It seems really simple until you start doing it.
I know.
It requires some knowledge. So, align yourself with a great local nursery that knows this stuff, that can help you out. Join your native plant society. Go to volunteer events. For example, plant sales in the spring. We're just getting into that season. There's so many native plant sales where knowledgeable people help you choose the right plants and get you a little bit further down the road with this.
So it's not all about adding plants. I mean, the book, your approach, it's not all about just adding more plants. It's also about other sort of ecosystem supporting cultural tactics, like, for example, not using chemicals, very important.
Mm-hmm.
So some of us are starting our spring cleanup, or maybe in warmer zones than you and I are in. They've already started. You have toward the end of the book a page with some eco-beneficial cultural tips for each season, and I just thought we could kind of go over some of the spring ones to get us off to a smart, eco-beneficial kind of a start, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the ways that you would approach cleanup that might be a little different from the old days.
Well, I think the first order of business is to remember that you're not just providing floral resources, you're providing habitat. You're providing a place where pollinators are living, overwintering in some cases, nesting, hiding, getting protection from predators, et cetera. So your garden's an ecosystem. Whether you want an ecosystem or not, it is. So if we start thinking in that way, we can be much more successful in planting for pollinators and providing all of the resources. So cleanup is tricky. Because if you're like me, the way I learned as a gardener was to be meticulously clean. Well, the Nelly need in me has long since vanished.
Me too, Kim. I have to say that's been the biggest change. The way that I clean up fall and spring is the biggest change since I've started to understand some of this stuff.
And why? Well, we might like it neat and tidy, but, you know, that's not always great for nature and for wildlife. So just thinking back to the fall, what should we have done or not done? Well, for those of us who live in a forested ecosystem here in the Northeast, lots of the Midwest, et cetera, depending on where you are, we have forests, we have trees, we kind of emulate those systems in our own landscapes with those layers that we've been talking about. And, of course, trees do what? They drop their leaves.
Right.
That's what's supposed to happen. Those leaves then decompose, macro and micro invertebrates that are going to help decompose those leaves, and they develop essentially a nutrient cycling system for our soil. So there's something else that goes on there, too, which really is an implication for why you need to keep leaves in place. There are tons of invertebrates in that leaf litter.
Yes.
Tons.
Yeah.
And so maybe there's a morning cloak butterfly that can overwinter as an adult in leaf litter. It has a chemical in its body that's like antifreeze, and it can actually survive that way.
Yes, or under a little bark.
I'm sorry,
even.
Go ahead.
Sometimes under a little bark, it might hide under some bark
on
a tree.
That too. But that leaf litter, there are lots of critters in an immature stage or sometimes in a mature stage that are really crucial for healthy ecosystems. And then think in the spring when migrating birds are coming back and they are looking for food. And, you know, for all of us who know and love Doug Tallamy's work and his book, Bringing Nature Home, we've learned that, you know, like 96% of land birds feed insects to their young.
Right.
We need a lot of insects in our landscapes.
Right.
So in the spring, so what do you do? So you've left all this stuff. You haven't cut your perennials back in the fall. You haven't moved the leaves. Those perennials, by the way, particularly pithy stem ones, can become habitat. If sometimes you'll see that, gosh, if you have a broken off stem in the garden, you might have an aggregation of ladybugs that overwinter as adults in that pithy stem, or it could be an overwintering bee. There's a lot of activity going on in the garden that we may not be noticing. And, of course, by leaving our perennials up, we're also providing a seed source for birds that are overwintering and other mammals. So when do we start cutting back? That's a tough one.
Yeah.
Climate change has made this really challenging.
Yes.
And we can't always predict, you know, what the temperature is going to be at any given time of year. So my general suggestion is wait until we've had a consistent number of days where we're well into the 50s, because that's when insect activity starts up. And make sure that when you start to cut back your garden, you're doing so when the soil's not soaking wet, because the enemy of healthy soil is compacted soil.
Yes.
When we step on wet soil, bad news. So, and then take it easy, slowly, instead of cutting everything back the same day, stage it. You know, maybe not all the insects in your landscape have woken up. Maybe we're going to get a cold spell when you think, oh, you know, we're now in spring. Maybe we're not so much now in spring. So those are my suggestions
right.
in terms of cleanup.
Right. Okay. So we're going to be a little bit slower, and we're not going to go through there with a giant, you know, blower,
weed whacker.
Shredder, weed whacker, oh my goodness, you know, assault on nature kind of a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Gentle,
okay.
gentle.
Okay. So the book and also the movement sort of ecological landscaping, they have this message of connectivity, I think. And, and you know, you and Kim in your yard, Margaret over in my yard, we can do things, but it's even better if we connect the dots. And Doug Tallamy's new book, a lot of it is about that, about how we can kind of create this homegrown national park by all contributing our small piece, you know, and so I know that you do a podcast, and one of your interviews, I think it was in December 2019, was with the founder of Bee City USA, I think.
Styles,
yeah, and so that's an example of a sort of blown up, you know, a big connectivity program. And I wondered if you could kind of just talk to us about why connectivity, why not just doing this as a little isolated island is so important.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, you can, you know, just kind of see yourself that if the only resource, and sadly this is the case in much of Westchester where I live, if the only resource is a little patch of landscape, the pollinators that you're trying to attract and support are very limited in terms of what they have available to them. And to get to the next landscape that might be a quarter mile away, well, that's a bit of a challenge. And some of our pollinators travel a fair amount of mileage. You know, like a bumblebee, a strong bumblebee can go a mile. A little bee might only go 100 feet. But hummingbirds and,
right,
you know, some of our other winged pollinators are going to be able to travel butterflies, you know, long distances. So if we think of monarchs as a model, that kind of gives us a goal, is we need to help them along their entire route, whatever that may be. And so having landscapes that are connected in terms of resources and habitat really helps. It's very much like the wildlife pathways that have existed for many decades with wildlife managers. You know, if you go out into, say, Montana or parts of the West, you will see these wildlife ramps over,
right,
highways,
right,
for large, you know, animals to actually get safely from one area to another. Well, pity the poor bee, for example, that's trying to get from your one patch of habitat and forage to another area, and it's got to cross a highway.
Right.
Much better that your neighbors have more resources and they don't have to travel as far.
So communicating really with making known what you're doing and communicating and sort of joining some of these group efforts.
Totally. And influencing neighbors, family, and friends. I've had a number of clients who, after we've installed landscapes that are ecological, pollinator-friendly, they'll have me come do a walk and talk in their garden, and we'll give plants away to their neighbors and friends and do kind of a formal arrangement, you know, a little garden tour, an explanation, and get people jazzed up about this. I think most people want to help. They just don't always know what to do. So sharing that message and signage, I think, is tremendously underutilized in our landscapes. So whether it's a pollinator garden sign, the Xerces Society is a fantastic resource for one of those. That's a nonprofit organization that's akin to, I've heard it described as the counterpart to Audubon, but for invertebrates.
Mm-hmm.
But get signage in your landscape where people can see it and get that message out that you're gardening differently, you're gardening with a purpose. And then, of course, you know, sharing your garden, have garden parties, provide opportunities for people to kind of see how this works, and find some volunteer opportunities, your local church or school, et cetera, that maybe has some vacant area that you could help turn into a pollinator garden. And then we can take it even further, like is going on now in the Northeast, with the pollinator pathway movement, where throughout Westchester County and a good part of Fairfield County, Connecticut, different municipalities are joining the pollinator pathways, and you can get your particular landscape on the map, and there's a big push to educate, inform, and assist folks in doing that.
Mm. Well, we're running short on time, but I wanted just to tell everybody that, again, we're going to have a book giveaway with the transcript. There's a great appendix at the back, which is kind of a short course, 10 tips for a thriving pollinator victory garden. We've covered most of them, and I'll add in the transcript any that we missed. But thank you so much, Kim. I mean, I think it's such an important message. I'll also give links, by the way, to Bee City USA, which I want to learn more about.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the tip on that. And thank you for making the time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Margaret. It's been my pleasure.
I hope I'll talk to you soon again. Thanks.
Thanks.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher, or iTunes, or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at Facebook or on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.